Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, returning to talk about the series of crimes most often attributed to a single entity called the Long Island Serial Killer. In the recent episode on Shannon Gilbert, who was possibly a Lisk victim, we talked about how her mysterious flight from an unknown predator, whether physical or psychological, resulted in an equally baffling death that has interested parties divided as to whether it was a tragic accident or murder. Shannon took off running from the home of Joseph Brewer, evading her driver Michael Pack in the process as well. While she claimed, quote-unquote, they were after her and trying to kill her, what seemed to be a thorough investigative process by law enforcement led to a conclusion that neither Brewer or Pack had attempted to harm Shannon in any way. The recent release of the 911 calls related to the incident seemed to tell the same story. Shannon was enduring some type of psychological breakdown, perhaps even psychosis, and likely due to a cocktail of substances she might have consumed during the night. Brewer and Shannon left the home together in his Jeep for what is described as 10 to 15 minutes and promptly returned without anything tangible in their hands, such as a bag from a store, according to driver Michael Pack, who was still outside waiting to give Shannon a ride home later. Of course, he left when she took off running and did so because he was knowingly transporting a sex worker, which is illegal and something he had tried to minimize in terms of liability by having Shannon meet him in Manhattan instead of her home in Jersey City, allowing him to avoid the much more serious implication of taking her across state lines. And of course, as a driver, if the person you're supposed to drive home runs away from you into darkness while knocking on doors and yelling about how you're going to kill her, leaving seems reasonable. The 911 call showed us that Shannon did not respond to multiple attempts to help her and was especially afraid of the police. Some have wondered if her fear of the cops meant the killer was one, but I think what's more likely is that, as a sex worker in the midst of doing a job and high on drugs, she's also terrified by what's insinuated within an encounter with the police. So, Shannon runs to both the homes of Gus Coletti and Barbara Brennan, who both call 911, adding to the 911 call Shannon had started long ago, and which lasted nearly 23 minutes. Between these sightings and calls, we understand that Shannon did not appear to have been physically attacked and that she ran freely away from all parties involved up to this point, from the John to her driver to the witnesses inside their homes. We hear her rapid footsteps on the phone call to 911 as she runs away, and according to Barbara Brennan, Shannon had disappeared from sight in darkness at the point of reaching a neighbor's house inhabited by Dr. Peter Hackett. This is where Shannon is finally out of the sight of anyone who's trying to help her, and has become much more vulnerable, both physically and psychologically, by isolating herself, or at least seemingly isolating herself. Between the drug usage, exhaustion, cooler temperatures, and Shannon's clothing being removed, it seems logical that she ran off behind Dr. Peter Hackett's home, went into the marsh, struggled to escape the unseen manifestation of whatever was chasing her emotionally, making it 3/4 of a mile through really harsh terrain in dark conditions, and finally collapsed. Her remains were found partially upright, leaning against the tall reeds in the marsh. And again, if she was undergoing a psychotic break, then it would be common to see the shedding of the clothes, even if impractical or downright unwise, because the victim is motivated by symbolic resonance rather than logic in a psychotic state. Something was likely chasing Shannon in her head, and so, in that location, when she took off running, her mindset, as we see with going to the neighbor's homes, would be to get out of the place in her head and into someone else's. She wants to become a different person and is saying it symbolically. It's a common goal, but it's manifesting here physically by trying to get inside other people's homes, aka heads, and then proceeding to refuse the help moments later because it obviously isn't going to work. So if you wanted to go inside, so to speak, where you could hide, but also wanted to run, two things which were irreconcilable in the context of both seeking help and running from it, how would that manifest physically here? Well, Shannon runs into the reeds and also hides in there by default of the fact they're tall and it's nighttime. This is basically a horror movie, as discussed extensively in the previous episode about Shannon's case. And in a horror movie, first the protagonist runs, then she hides, and then she fights back. Yet if you don't have the strength to fight back, meaning your foe is psychological, all you can do is run and hide. There is no way to fight back physically against an emotional issue chasing you down. So normally, a final girl in a horror movie would double down eventually by not running and hiding, thereby creating a new road right down the middle of that fork in the old one in the form of evolving to become a person who fights. Notice the disunity of the fork in the road, and notice that creating the straight line through that fork in a new decision gives you unity again. It brings those lines together, so you're creating unity from disunity. Yet, if you're manifesting this entity from an issue in your head, and physicality is your only option, then doubling down, as we just talked about, leaves you with choosing to both run and hide. So Shannon runs away and intentionally disappears from sight, aka hides, as we understand from the testimony by Barbara Brennan, and then she doubles down by both running through the marsh with the tall reeds and hiding in there. Yet the danger again caused by isolation is that if she does this, then there's not actually a destination at which she can arrive. She just has to keep doing more of the same, like a tragic protagonist headed for a disaster for refusal to change. To me, 3/4 of a mile through that heavy brush and muddy ground, while exhausted, terrified, and cold, along with being lit up on drugs to the point you had a breakdown, would render a situation in which you could crash. I doubt it was any one factor that killed Shannon. Rather, it was likely a number of factors, from exposure to exhaustion to drug intake and more. This is where the controversy comes in, and how her case is most legitimately linked to the Lisk murders. The autopsy conducted after the discovery of her remains did not indicate damage to the hyoid bone. Yet the independent autopsy ordered by the family showed the opposite. The implication here is that the hyoid bone is a small bone in the region of the neck which has a strong propensity, if not nearly a certainty, for breaking under the force of acts such as manual strangulation and hangings. In the absence of such an event, it's rare to witness damage to the hyoid bone. Now, it's difficult to discern the truth here. It's possible the initial autopsy, whether accidentally or intentionally, failed to indicate damage to the hyoid bone. Or, conversely, perhaps they didn't find damage to the hyoid bone, and it was instead the finding of an independent examiner inclined to lean toward results conducive to the outcome the hiring party wants to indulge. We don't know. Like most things in the Lisk case, this part is a mystery. A person certainly could have grabbed Shannon, killed her and dumped her in the marsh. But since she was already running in the direction of the marsh and ended up dead there, a very short distance away, it seems reasonable to suggest that the only suspicious person Shannon might have encountered by chance along that path was Dr. Peter Hackett, the homeowner. She would have gone through his backyard to get to the marsh, something later supported by the discovery of some of her personal items 75 feet from the house going in that direction. Now, why is Dr. Peter Hackett suspicious? Well, we could reach and say that he's a man who was rumored to have been quite liberal in prescribing and supplying certain medications that are hard to acquire for most people, such as opiates. In fact, if there was any person in the neighborhood who was well equipped to handle a breakdown of Shannon's magnitude, at least in terms of the ability to provide something to calm her and keep her from running, it seems it would have been him. Yet in order for that to have happened, he would have had to have snatched her up along the way. If she had just likely ingested something that put her over the edge, encountering a strange man offering the same is very likely not going to be appealing to her. Yet, if this person did happen to grab her, then that would be apparent to the people looking for her because, in her current mental state at the time, meaning being incredibly afraid, she would have screamed if physically accosted. Nobody heard anything of the sort. So, is it possible she went into the marsh and got lost, at which point the doctor learned about what was going on, and he only encountered her later when she reemerged? Sure. But the easiest, most reasonable path to the truth here is knowing that Shannon, in the midst of what was seemingly a psychotic breakdown, actually went to the place where the trajectory of her movements when last witnessed suggested she went. There is no inconsistency there. She disappeared while running in that direction and was later found dead in a manner that insinuates a continuous forward movement from that point until she could go no further and collapsed. She also could have gone in circles multiple times, as the reeds and darkness would prove deceptive in trying to ascertain her positioning, especially in her condition. It's also possible that going into the marsh and being unable to find her way out, like being caught in a maze while having that feeling of being chased, something that made The Shining a classic horror movie, caused Shannon to succumb to a heart attack or similar. Women her age generally don't die of heart attacks, but the right combination of drug usage, exhaustion, and terror leading to dehydration could ultimately drop a person like a stone. If we consider the output of energy she was indulging as she fled the people trying to help her, specifically the fast footsteps of her running and stated fear of someone trying to kill her, we have to wonder how long she could keep it up. Sure, she would eventually sober from the drugs, and the psychotic episode, in one way or another, would recede or even end, but in the meantime, her body is working in overdrive in the worst way. Imagine how much adrenaline would be pumping through you if you believed people were right behind you trying to kill you. When we run from something and our adrenaline is pumping, our belief is either that we can outrun it or that we need to buy time until we can't. So we run until running makes us more vulnerable than taking the risk of fighting back. That's what our bodies expect, that we will flee and escape the danger, or that, in the absence of being able to and unwilling to fight back, simply run until which point we are forced to fight back. These are all short-term options. All of which is to say that this absolute terror of being chased on foot through harsh terrain by someone trying to kill you, again, is supposed to be a short-term endeavor. Yet, since a psychological ailment can't actually run us down physically, here, Shannon is running around like a maniac for what is perhaps hours, when in reality, anything physical that was actually chasing her would have succeeded or failed by then, in terms of a predator. But the manifested monster has no limitations, and that's why it can keep chasing her, and also why the seemingly human villains in our horror movies are afforded supernatural ability. It's all emotional. It's just projections of emotion. Now, here's where it gets weird. As I mentioned in the previous episode, Dr. Peter Hackett, the homeowner and emergency services doctor, calls Mary Gilbert, Shannon's mom, a couple of days after the disappearance. He initially tells her that he runs a home for wayward girls, and Shannon went there. According to the doctor, on the night of Shannon's disappearance, when she took off, she came to his home terrified, paranoid, and seeking help, and he was able to administer some type of medication to calm her down. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Recently, when coming upon a transitional period in my life, I had a dilemma that, of course, came down to choosing one thing or another, and didn't allow room in my life for both anymore. Something had to go. But how do I choose, I wondered. I crunched numbers. I listed pros and cons. And then I realized something. Maybe the most important component to this decision is the emotional one. How will it affect me, regardless of what I choose? I realized that I didn't have the answer and wouldn't be able to find it in a user manual for my brain that I happened to have lying around on the coffee table. That's when I learned about the benefits of therapy. Therapists are trained to help you figure out the cause of challenging emotions and learn productive coping skills, which makes therapy the closest thing to a guided tour of the complex engine called you. As the world's largest therapy service, BetterHelp has matched 3 million people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists available 100% online. Plus, it's affordable. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a therapist. If things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. It couldn't be simpler. No waiting rooms, no traffic, no endless searching for the right therapist. Learn more and save 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/ccmm. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/CCMM. So, is it possible Shannon banged on the back door of this man's home? And, as the doctor suggests, he was her knight in shining armor, saving her from whatever was chasing her, calming her down, and getting her life back on track by getting the damaged sex worker into his home for wayward girls? Well, aside from the fact that he lied about running a home for wayward girls, sure, it's possible. But to me, this sounds like a fantasy. He's described as someone who likes to flex his importance. And what I see here is a man making himself the central point of action in a situation in which what he's saying is simply not supported by evidence. We have to remember that this phone call takes place before the remains are found. In reality, there was no reason for Hackett to contact Mary to try and lead her astray if he was actually involved in her death. To the contrary, he's misleading her in a way that says he is the person who made everything okay. To me, this seems more like the product of lying due to low self-esteem and inflated ego, rather than a killer covering his tracks. The overarching theme of what Shannon needed that night when she ran and could not get was help. And being a person who literally could have provided something to calm and stop Shannon, along with his house being right in her path, I think he was so strongly inclined to play the role of savior in a fantasy that he ignored an obvious reality that the police were going to learn about this call. After he does it, he later calls Mary back and denies having ever said any of the things of which she accuses him, including interacting with Shannon, giving her medication, and having a home for wayward girls. Yes, it seems very suspicious, but I'm inclined to believe he did this for selfish, narcissistic reasons, and in the aftermath, realized the potential consequences were not of his liking, causing him to backtrack on everything he said. The authorities, of course, investigated the doctor and did not believe he was actually connected to Shannon's death. Furthermore, they don't think that he was involved in the Lisk killings. But we can't just ignore this incident. I mean, given what's to come, the unveiling of a massive graveyard full of a serial killer's victims right next door to Dr. Peter Hackett's home? Wouldn't it be wise to think that perhaps he had something else to hide? Something that made him desperate enough to call Mary and hope she bought his story about her daughter, thereby causing her to ease the pressure on police to act in the case? Is it possible he was doing his part to divert attention away from that area for the obvious reason that Shannon disappearing there would bring police scrutiny? It looks like that, for sure. To this point, however, their investigation says he was not doing that. Yet here we have a man who tried so desperately, almost to the point of comedy, to pull a fast one on Mary Gilbert as though she wouldn't indulge the least bit of due diligence in her effort to learn if what he said was true. I think the greater part of the delusion is due to a common assessment, which is often correct, that asserts the families of sex workers don't care. I think this happened due to his narcissism. It's clearly sociopathic in nature. Some of those families are in such disarray or have fractured or even irreconcilable relationships among their members that yes, in some circumstances, that phone call might have been received as legitimate and the receiving party would not have looked any further into it either due to apathy or simply not wanting to know if something horrible happened. It's a harsh reality, but some people have family, yet not loved ones. That wasn't the case with Shannon. Her family wanted to know the truth. So did Dr. Peter Hackett backtrack on his false claim about the home for wayward girls because he made a selfish mistake during a gesture intended to put him up on a pedestal as a savior? Or was he counteracting guilt in relation to being the opposite of Shannon's savior as her killer? The investigation of these things again, suggests that Shannon's death was an accident and that Dr. Peter Hackett was a guy known for inserting himself into high-profile events to look important. Shannon's trajectory to her disappearance that night was a perfect opportunity for him to play savior. So, was he just hiding that single lie? Or was that the last thread holding together the massive secrets about to be uncovered in the aftermath? It does stand to reason that if Mary Gilbert and Shannon's other family members relented in relation to finding Shannon in that location and did not pressure law enforcement, that the bodies of the Lisk victims would have remained a secret. Yet due to that pressure, the truth was unveiled. And among everybody involved, who actively lied in a way that would potentially prevent it, whether it was his intention or not. Dr. Peter Hackett. Ultimately, as far as Hackett goes, we have smoke, but nothing that leads back to fire. Now, when we take a look at suspects in this next episode, we'll swing back around to talking a bit more about this mysterious man. So, that was May 2010 when Shannon disappeared. In December 2010, the police finally get around to searching the area in an effort to uncover Shannon's remains. In the process, one of the cadaver dogs being used hit on a burlap sack found on the north side of Ocean Parkway. This was the moment that had a domino effect on this location being revealed as a graveyard for serial killers' victims. Inside the burlap sack were the dismembered remains of a young woman who turned out to be 24-year-old Melissa Bartholomew. That was December 11th, 2010. Strangely enough, soon after that discovery, they found the remains of Shannon Gilbert. And on December 13th, located perhaps no more than 500 feet apart, law enforcement discovered the remains of three more women. Along with Melissa Bartholomew, 25-year-old Maureen Brainerd Barnes, 22-year-old Megan Waterman, and 27-year-old Amber Lynn Costello became known as the Gilgo Beach Four, as they were the four initial LISC victims discovered. In varying stages of decay, all had been dismembered and were believed to have been strangled. They were dumped there in the same type of burlap sack, all of which combined says this could be the work of a serial killer. All of the women were working as paid escorts, and all had been advertising through Craigslist. Melissa Bartholomew had been living in the Bronx and disappeared in July 2009 after making a deposit to her bank account and meeting with a client. For more than a month afterward, as I previously mentioned, her 15-year-old sister Amanda received calls from her phone, meaning her sister's phone, in which a strange man taunted and harassed her about Melissa. Ultimately, he told her that Melissa was dead. On June 6, 2010, Megan Waterman left her hotel about 15 miles away from Gilgo Beach in Long Island, heading out to meet a customer after placing a Craigslist ad for her services, and was never seen alive again. Maureen Brainerd Barnes, a mother of two, had supposedly left sex work in the rearview mirror for legitimate opportunities, but upon having trouble paying her mortgage, she returned to advertising on Craigslist to get clients. On July 9th, 2007, while working out of a motel, she, like Megan Waterman and Melissa Bartholomew, said she was meeting a client outside of the hotel, and for the obvious reason that the John was willing to pay more. Amber Lynn Costello was a heroin addict who had begun using drugs as a teen in response to childhood trauma, having allegedly been molested by a neighbor when she was only 6 years old. She was living in West Babylon, about 10 miles north of Gilgo Beach, at the time of her disappearance on September 2, 2010. A prospective client had allegedly called her multiple times that evening, offering far in excess of Amber's usual fee. She agreed for $1,500, which, as you can imagine, is significantly more today, 12 years later. Notice how easy it is to take these women, to make them let their guards down by simply utilizing the manifestation of increased self-worth through offering significantly more money. Many of these people come from abusive backgrounds in which they were made to feel worthless unless they satisfy the abuser's needs. So when they satisfy a client's needs and can actually accompany that idea with a large dollar amount, it symbolizes a man as a father figure or provider validating their self-worth in a big way. Logic and reason don't often get in the way of emotional needs. If you have low self-esteem and a high degree of self-loathing and feelings of worthlessness, then you will place that need of correcting it above your safety if the risk involved leads to a result in which your self-worth has apparently skyrocketed. And the type of person who would know how to do this best, who would know how to use it against you, is someone who was also abused as a child. Abusers commonly pay off victims, and in many ways, but in the context of a sex worker, we understand cash is king. If a man agrees to pay a woman much more than any other man pays for that same service, it says that the person spending the money thinks the sex worker in question is special. They're worthwhile. That's what people want to feel. And again, in a context of paid sex, being made to feel special and having your self-worth validated comes by way of someone offering significantly more money. However, the last thing the police wanted to do was investigate the disappearance and death of sex workers. So as the December findings became a sensational story about a serial killer's graveyard, the police in Suffolk County used the winter and its associated conditions as an excuse for ending the search until spring. Yes, it's very cold in New York in December, especially on the ocean, but as they had just proven, the cold weather didn't stop them from having success. The issue here is that they, along with the media and public, knew that there would be more bodies to find. And there were. In early 2011, when the search resumed, they discovered the partial remains of 20-year-old Jessica Taylor, specifically her head and her hands. At a later point, in Manorville, miles away from Gilgo Beach, they found her torso lying on a sheet of plastic atop a pile of scrap wood. Now, an interesting thing here, and something we'll talk about more in the next episode with our review of suspects, is that when Melissa Bartholomew's mom was able to get her daughter's phone records for the time of her disappearance, she noticed a number of calls to Manorville, insinuating that perhaps the client she planned to meet was from there. Within a week of Jessica Taylor being discovered at Gilgo Beach, in early April 2011, a Jane Doe was found. She was the sixth victim of Lisk to be uncovered at the location, and DNA later revealed her to be Valerie Mack, a 24-year-old sex worker who disappeared all the way back in the year 2000. Like Jessica Taylor, her head and hands were at Gilgo Beach, along with 1 foot, while her torso was found dumped near Taylor's in Manorville. It had been stuffed inside of a garbage bag and dumped near power lines. Now, for anybody wondering about the emotional or psychological component being indulged by dismemberment of the bodies, and specifically removing limbs or parts of limbs, and then separating them from the torso, here's the deal. The core issue with an abuse victim is emotional disunity. You were abused back in childhood in the past and became emotionally stunted due to that trauma, meaning the child who had been hurt lived on inside your head, seeking resolution to what ails them, while their body simply continued to grow to an adult. That's how we get a man-child like the serial killers we talk about. They are living in men's bodies, and yet that child from so long ago is still in their heads, still haunting them, and still waiting for something to happen to make things right so they can finally rest. That means, for all intents and purposes, the man-child was deconstructed or torn apart emotionally, as we all are in our younger years growing to adulthood, and left in pieces, yet unable to put it all back together again, specifically by finding unity between their emotional and physical worlds to become whole again. Since they are suffering that emotionally, they often project their childhood selves physically onto a victim and thereby manifest the idea of the person being torn apart emotionally and unable to put themselves back together. So we get victims who are torn apart, and because nobody came to the rescue to find out what was wrong with the killer when he was a kid and put him back together again, he takes pleasure in creating this disunity within his victims and forcing others to come try to put them back together again in an effort to do what? Learn who they really are. It's a process of becoming. As you put the pieces together, you learn their identity. You learn who they really are. And that's a maturation process simply manifested in murder. But that unity leads, again, to identity. And furthermore, becoming whole again. And so I'll talk about it more later, but I don't think it's a coincidence that a torso was found in Manorville on top of a stack of wood, and one of our suspects, who was actually a carpenter, lived in the Manorville area back then. People are trying to tell you how they hurt emotionally when they commit violent crimes. Accordingly, we understand that abuse victims, more than anything else, suffer their powerlessness against the situation, especially children. So when the other torso connected to Manorville is found, where is it? It's at the junction of electrical lines doing what? Conducting power. This is an emotionally traumatized killer, one feeling powerlessness from abuse in the past. We notice that the hands, feet, and heads are most popular for removing, and it's because those things are most closely correlated with autonomy or freedom of movement. It removes nearly all considerations involving our senses, thematically bringing one idea to the surface, one that reigns supreme in abusive homes. Ignorance. Silence. So to symbolize the need to break that silence and become the person you're supposed to be by putting yourself back together again, aka being symbolically reborn in adulthood as a new person, you force others to go in search of those things that manifest the idea of moving forward in life and being able to feel properly, such as feet and hands. Recovering the head returns the sight and clarity of mind, eradicating ignorance. The killer is placing significant distance between those body parts and the torsos to show us the emotional gap he's experiencing from this disunity. That gaping space is the emotional wound that needs to be closed through unity. Think of the fork in the road that we talked about earlier. When you plow the straight line through the fork, that is symbolic of closing those forks and making the straight line, bringing unity from disunity. So because he's incapable of emotional growth or movement, it's manifested in narcissistic sociopathy by getting revenge through making physical sacrifices to others instead of emotional sacrifices to himself. It's projection. He doesn't leave the past behind emotionally. Instead, he leaves it behind physically in order to tell his story in a way that circumvents the emotional necessity of doing the hard work to change and let go. And that inability to let go is what often results in these killers choosing manual strangulation as their murder weapon of choice, as we see here with Lisk. Again, that work in sociopathy becomes physical, and so we see it projected upon the victims. As adults, we all have the story about what happened to us as kids in terms of trauma to make us the person we are today. But for some people, those experiences were so awful and horrifying that they simply can't talk about them. And the worst of those people suffering, the ones who really need to say it but can't, will craft physical narratives with violence in order to project their emotional pain upon a physical palette where it can be translated into that story I mentioned about what hurts. We all tell that story. Some of us do it over a glass of wine, others in therapy. But for the rare man with demons raging inside his heart, killing is what suffices. It probably sounds very strange to you on the surface. It does to me. Why would you tell a story in blood, we ask? That's insane. Yet if we take even a cursory look at the world we live in, what we see is that nearly the entire history of living creatures has been told in blood, in killing, in death. It is only our evolution that veils this truth, that veils that reality. We are becoming more civil, and so civility is based in emotional change, meaning these killers aren't equipped to do it, so they choose what has been the most effective storytelling tool in the history of life on Earth: killing. You and I are not mortal because it's a good design. It's an inferior design. It's terrible. The worst. You and I are mortal because death and the constant threat of it are without question the greatest vehicles for creating drama in the universe. It's called history for a reason, his story, and stories are based in drama. You and I each serve as a microcosm of that idea in the form of a person, and therefore, just as a deity like God has his story or history, so does our killer, Lisk, and so do you. And again, you might tell yours in therapy, you might do it over a glass of wine, but some motherfuckers go out there and rip people's heads off. And as scary as it is, they're not doing anything different than what we are. They are just doing it in a far less civilized way. Now, on the same day Valerie Mack was discovered, and right near her remains, they located the remains of a toddler, specifically a girl. Due to the close proximity, it was believed that Mack was most likely her mother. However, at the conclusion of DNA testing, strangely enough, they were not connected. In fact, the toddler was subsequently connected to another murder victim. It turned out her mother's unidentified body had been discovered in Nassau County, 7 miles away, at least in part. The rest of the body was found in the Jones Beach area. That woman has come to be known as Peaches, as she had a tattoo of a dripping peach. So, around the same time as the Jane Doe and Baby Doe discoveries in April 2011, authorities endured what was, to that point, perhaps the most perplexing revelation unearthed at the site along Gogo Beach: the remains of a man. An Asian male, one who had been dressed in women's clothing and who, to the contrary of what the other victims suffered in terms of strangulation, had actually succumbed by way of blunt force trauma to the head. This victim was described as being small, with a very slim build, and so, in combination with the women's clothing on his body, it seems reasonable, but not certain, to suggest he presented himself to the client, Lisk, as a woman, and upon the revelation of his true sex, enraged the client, who felt as though he had been fooled, and took his revenge. If we examine the other known victims, we see a general pattern, though not an exclusive one, that shows nearly all of them were very small in stature. Valerie Mack was 5 feet tall. Jessica Taylor was 5 feet 3 inches tall. Amber Lynn Costello was 5 feet tall. Melissa Bartholomew was 4 feet 10 inches tall. Maureen Brainerd Barnes was 4 feet 11 inches tall. At 5 feet 5 inches tall, Megan Waterman was the tallest of this group. But while she was the tallest, we should also note that, at 22, she was the youngest, and that might have made her more acceptable. So, it's not too much of a stretch to believe that this Asian male with a very slight build was also short and would have passed for a woman until the point of intimate physical contact. It would seem almost incredibly stupid to try to fool a person like this, as you might end up getting hurt for it, which I discussed in the Josh Guimond episode recently. But there is absolutely no question that the easiest way to get paid for sex and get the highest rate possible is to be one thing above and beyond anything else, which is a woman. Desperate people do desperate things, and sometimes a desperate person might be inclined to convince himself that everything is going to be okay, that the client won't care at the time of revelation. But we see from the blunt force trauma to the head that this is an extremely high-risk lifestyle, and a very risky choice, of course. It's sobering to realize there are people who have to indulge such extreme risk just to get by, but they do. Of course, there is also speculation that this male dressed as a woman was actually a trans person in the process of their transformation. We don't know. That desire to obtain young, small victims is likely derived from this killer suffering abuse at the hands of a parent or both parents as a child, and he is then later projecting that abuse onto seemingly childlike victims. What we often see in such situations is that the killer actually becomes attracted to children and seeks them as victims. However, what seems apparent here is that this person, in lieu of having his sexuality corrupted through abuse in a way that caused him to be attracted to children, has decided to engage adults who are physically mature but small in stature. Now, nearing mid-April 2011, police also discovered a skull on a nearby beach in Nassau County, which they believe is connected to Lisk. Strangely enough, through DNA, they were able to connect that skull to a set of legs belonging to a woman which had been found on the bay side of Fire Island, washed up on a beach, all the way back on April 20th, 1996. Wow. So, while there are certainly other cases, both officially and unofficially linked to Lisk, what seems to be true is that we have a killer who started as early as April 1996, if not before, and so bringing that notion into 2011 and the discovery of the bodies, what we see is the likelihood that the Long Island serial killer is exceptionally prolific, and that the collection of victims at present could potentially only represent a small percentage of the real total. Given the sheer number of cases that seem to flirt around the periphery of Lisk, we'd have to believe some are in fact connected, and of course some are not. So we have close to a dozen official victims, but there could be many more. In addition to that, we see a stretch of murders that could have transpired over the course of at least 15 years and at most several decades, lending itself to the notion that this is a meticulous and calculated person, one who is wary of technological considerations related to detection, and in the places where he remains vulnerable to it, as we all are, he seems to have utilized resources, specifically money, to buy his way into avoiding it. When the killer took the phone of Melissa Bartholomew and later used it to make calls from places like Midtown Manhattan and Fire Island to terrorize the younger girl in relation to her missing sister, he subsequently did the opposite, which was to pay the girls a lot of money, well in excess of their normal fee, for the implied right to create rules contrary to good sense and safety so that he could remain undetected. Some of these later victims left behind their phones and purses and elected to go with someone who had earned their trust and did so for large sums of money because that amount, for a sex worker of this type, again, is directly connected to self-worth. If you know anything about this type of work, one of the greatest joys a person can feel is taking a big fee in excess of their normal rate because it means one thing. They will just have that much longer until they have to do it again. So here, we have somebody who is both technologically savvy in the sense that the transition from flip phones to smartphones had him asking girls to leave such things at home, and also someone with the means to buy that luxury. The more you get paid, the fewer questions you tend to ask. In the case of Melissa Bartholomew, she was offered $1,000 for the night by Lisk and was therefore happy to overlook the usual safety precautions involved. Again, that's $1,000 15 years ago, or close to 15 years ago. Amber Lynn Costello had been contacted by her client perhaps 3 or 4 times on the night of her disappearance, and it was only when he offered $1,500 for her services that night that they finally agreed to meet. One would think that throughout these killings, and especially the events preceding and subsequent to them, at some point Lisk would get caught, just due to being so prolific. But he hasn't. Sure, he could be incarcerated for something else, or even many things. He could be older and simply tired of it all. He might be dead. So in the next episode, we're going to profile the Long Island serial killer and take a look at the known suspects. Is it one of them? Or is the man more elusive, someone unknown? And worse, is it possible that he could be a cop? We don't know. Hopefully, for the sake of the victims and families, we'll eventually have answers. In the meantime, let's take a moment to recognize that, along with the victims in this case, there are many other sex workers out in the world who are left to such tragic fates. People who suffer silently and by way of a painful past until finally, when they need a voice more than ever, they can't be heard at all. In some way, we must remember the lost, the broken, those who had dreams and chased them, only for it to end in heartache. So as we move into the final Lisk episode and talk about the profiling of suspects, I'll leave you with something strange to ponder. The police, after discovering the remains of Shannon Gilbert, took Mary Gilbert up onto the balcony at Dr. Peter Hackett's home to allow her a great view of the spot, in lieu of being able to take her out there on foot, due to the harsh terrain. So if the balcony at the doctor's house offered a perfect view of the spot where Shannon had been resting dead since May 2010, and her remains weren't discovered until December 2010, it means that in the span of approximately 7 months, despite Shannon being there, he never saw her. Or did he?